Welcome to the Morning Struggle Podcast. I'm Jesse.
And I'm Ty, and we bring you Habits of Successful People. Today we're talking about
biophilic design.
Whatever that means. Activate. Yeah, biophilic designs. Mm-hmm. You are just coming up with the fanciest of the words to make us all go, what?
This
sounds super sciencey and technical. It just means love of biology?
Yes, actually. But it's, biological things, nature and whatnot. The reason why this came up, This is relevant. So our kiddo, or actually most of our kiddos, want to go to space in some fashion.
They want to be astronauts. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
That's a rough one.
It's a rough one, but yeah, they want to be astronauts.
And that's scary as a mom being like, I got to talk to other astronaut moms. And see, how do you deal with
the
that?
The eight other astronaut moms that are around?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's exactly. But this idea of going to space, and I was looking up the issues that people would have going to Mars, and it is rough.
Well, there's no plants, just like you've seen. They have plants on the International Space Station because they miss that biophilia.
Well,
the biodiversity.
Biophilic, yeah. So, biophilia, yeah. So, this we have a natural attraction to nature. We want nature with us. We want to interact with it. It's better for our brains. And so, I actually went into this. And so, I'm going to, obviously, in the science and action, I'm going to go into it in more in depth. But it was really interesting how much humans actually still need nature.
They do. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you go to the store, you get a house plant, you water it. Episode done.
Thank you for joining us today.
How good are we? Okay.
It was so good.
So we're going to go into a history. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a science, a coffee segment, and an action plan.
Yes.
On how to look at plants.
Well, so here's the thing. Architecture?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Architecture now is more sterile. And so we're actually seeing, so space is an extreme version of it, right? But our day-to-day now is minus a lot of nature.
I can go through a whole day without seeing any nature.
And it's, yeah. Well, I mean, like you, although you have a window in your office.
I do have a window, but I overlook concrete. There are some trees, I guess.
Yeah, but it's pretty low, right?
High rises in concrete.
Yeah. So, but in doing that, we're having actual psychological issues because of this.
And she said, I've got a window at work. They took me out of the basement and put me in an office with a window in it.
Mm-hmm.
I can peep outside. Yep. I have to get on my tippy toes, but I can peep outside.
Still a window. No, but for real, we're having actual effects in our day-to-day, in day-to-day humans and in astronauts.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're practically the same. But in
astronauts are humans too, people.
That's right.
All right.
And so I'm going to tell you why we need to have more of this biophilic design.
Okay. How to incorporate nature into our life and why it's so important.
Yes.
I love it. Let's get into the history segment. I'm going to talk about plants.
This day in history.
This has got to be the most boring history segment I've ever researched in my entire life. Plants. They don't do much. They just sit there and then they grow and they evolve over 500 million years super slowly.
Mm-hmm.
They don't eat anything like crocodiles do. They don't have big wars or battles.
No.
What do? They just grow and then they grow a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. But you ready?
Yeah.
Evolution of plants. You don't think about this. You think about animals evolving, right?
Right.
So they're fast. Everything's happening. The bird's beak is longer. And so it's an easier, we talked about the Fibonacci sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little easier. So it can get in the nectar and then that bird gets to reproduce more. And then all the birds have long beaks. And wow, it's so interesting. Well, plants do the same thing. You don't think about it. But plants evolve over time because the ones that are adapted most for survival get to move on.
Yeah.
And as they get more and more complicated, they get more and more adapted to different environments.
Mm-hmm.
So you ready? 500 million years ago. 500 million years ago. That's a long time. That's when they think around that time is when they believe scientists, and paleobotanists, you know, people who study old plants.
Yeah, which
plant
is a
fossils.
Fantastic job.
It's a whole job. If you like that, it's a whole job. They said in oceans and in lakes, there was teeming with life. So you have early fishes, algae, mosses, ancient corals and invertebrates.
Mm-hmm.
All that was in the water.
Yeah.
But to come out of the water into the land was really hard because it's dry. Gravity affects you a lot more.
Oh,
so to make that move to land is a very hard thing to do. But during the Ordovician period, which was about 485 to 444 million years ago, the first plants gained foothold on land. They were, there's fossilized spores resembling those living plants called liverworts.
Okay.
Liverworts are little mossy plants. They're very short and they reproduce using spores.
Oh.
So plants reproduce with ova and sperm, right?
Right.
And so they have a male-female portion, sometimes in the same tree, mm-hmm. and they reproduce just like humans, essentially.
Yeah.
But early ones reproduce like fungi.
You send spores out, and then it's you. And isn't a clone of you?
It's a clone of you. But
whole bunch of Jessies out there.
Yep. But so these hair-like green algae prospered on the edges of ponds. And then the algae required new features that allowed it to survive in times of drought. So it's kind of on the edge of the pond. You get a drought period. The water recedes. Mm-hmm. And I'm on land now. Mm-hmm. What do I do? Well, only the strongest ones survive.
Yeah.
And so those ones are the ones that can now migrate onto their spores, pop out, and it gets pushed by the wind,
uh-huh.
and it lands on land. And instead of saying, "Look, I'm not in water. I guess I won't live," it says, "I'm a strong spore. I can live here."
And boom. It's a cage match.
Early pioneers.
Pioneers.
Think of early pioneers.
I like cage match.
Yep. And so, like I said, so that was the spores, and then we get into embryo stuff. But these liverworts, mm-hmm. they're non-vascular plants that reproduce via spores. They're small. They lack a sophisticated system for moving water through the plant. So they don't have, plants have essentially a vasculature, veins.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they get nutrients and water to different parts of the plants.
Yeah.
These liverworts, they don't. They just sit there like a big blob. They look like lizard skin. If you were to look at the plant, it looks like lizard skin because that's how they breathe. That's how they get water inside of them.
Interesting.
So like we said, the structural challenges, there's ultra harsh ultraviolet light. There's wind and gravity. And it's hard to obtain water and carbon dioxide from the air.
Oh.
So all these plants started to develop a waxy layer called a cuticle.
Okay.
So that's kind of started to protect them. Mm-hmm. Again, the ones who had the waxier layers were the ones who survived.
Yeah.
So now that's why you got that kind of feel on leaves and, you know, different things.
Oh.
That waxy feel, that protects them. It keeps them moist and protects them from the ultraviolet rays. So anyway, the early ones, they had rhizoids that were little structures anchoring the plant to the ground. So it's like the very first root system.
Feet.
It's like, I'm going to have little feet and I'm going to put it in the ground.
Uh-huh.
So then eventually the shoots became progressively taller with a spore sac on the top.
Okay.
If you were a foot tall and your spore sac was up top, well, the wind could take that and go farther.
Uh-huh.
My spore sac's a foot tall. How tall is your spore sac? And then you live longer.
Oh, my goodness.
So this was during the Silurian period, like 444 to 419 million years ago.
Well,
but they grew to be about several inches tall. They transported water, or transporting water became more challenging.
Uh-huh.
So they had to, the ones who developed these other more complicated systems, uh-huh. because their spore sac's tall, I can't get water to that spore sac, so I'm going to invent a xylem.
Okay.
A xylem is an artery that goes up there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? So
it's able to pump up the water
and everything? Pump up the water. And I don't understand how these turn on in nature. Maybe someone else does, but you got your DNA
mm-hmm.
and you only initiate 10% of it or whatever. So mm-hmm. who says, like, oh, I already knew that I was going to need this xylem, but I'm just going to turn it on in my DNA.
And then boom.
But that doesn't make any sense. This is not real. None of this world is real. It's what I got it. During this time, they started producing stomata. Stomata is how they breathe. It's how you get gas exchange in a plant.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So before that, not really much gas exchange.
Really?
So plants started having stomatas. You usually find them in leaves, but like the liverworts, they're all over the plant.
Oh, gotcha.
All right. Next one. You ready?
Yeah.
So then they started to evolve branches.
Okay.
So these are, we're talking initially, it's just one little stem.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you just got a stem and a spore sac. They start evolving some branches and new shoots. And some of them allowed for more stability, so mm-hmm. like a trunk.
Yeah.
And some of them branched out so they could get more sunlight or through photosynthesis, uh-huh. grow and get more nutrients.
Oh.
So that's where you start getting these branches. And they can start making more spores. And then they start going into the ova. All right. So that's the early plants.
Okay.
Now we get into the Devonian period.
Okay.
We're talking 419 million to 359 million years ago. We're talking about tree size plants and algae. Now they're getting fancy. They're getting roots. They're getting leaves. They're getting wood. They're getting seeds. This is the paleobotanists. This is their time. This is the one, because you start getting fossils. These are the early fossils.
See?
So you go and there's a regular paleontologist, and he says, look at my T-Rex skull. What? That's nothing. Well, I found some spores. And they go, oh my, those paleobotanists. We got to get them out of this dig. This is too much.
It would be pretty cool.
Yeah. But anyway, club mosses. Club mosses were some of the first plants that started growing tall in this modern day structure with roots and moss like leaves called microphylls.
Okay.
And they're around today still. They're like the crocodiles of the plant family. they're perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they absorb water and they feed upright. They have photosynthetic stems, so the whole plant absorbs sunlight.
Ooh, not they're just very
the
efficient.
Leaves. They're mm-hmm. very efficient. So that is club mosses, and that led the way to
Hold the phone. Is that what the Moss Amigos are?
Yeah, the Moss Amigos, the friends of the club mosses. Yep. No, that's you jokes. You're saying jokes during my plant evolution
segment. I think that might be, that was a legit question.
That was not a legit question. Moss means more in Spanish. Jokes, Jesse's got the jokes. Okay, so anyway, this gave rise to ferns and angiosperms. Do you know what angiosperms are?
Nope.
You love angiosperms.
Do
every Valentine's Day I say, here's your bouquet of angiosperms.
Are they flowers?
Flowers.
Yes.
Yep. So anyway.
Wait, you've never given me flowers on Valentine's Day.
I give you all
Day.
The time. So anyway, during this time, plants maxed out about 10 feet tall. But then, after these club mosses, over 25 feet tall, 3 feet wide. They had bulb-like bases, and then it looked like a palm tree.
Oh.
But they weren't palm trees because they didn't have any wood in them. Mm. They were just big upright stems.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And that was the late Devonian period. So then they could reach, by this time, they started incorporating wood into their cell structure.
Mm.
Now, when that happened, they could reach 100 feet tall with large fern-like leaves, creating the Earth's first forest.
Oh.
So we're talking this time, the late Devonian period, I don't know, 300 million years ago. This is when you get forests. So all of a sudden we go from little mosses on the ground to giant 100-foot trees, quote unquote trees, and forests in the ecosystem. But because of that, there was so much debris, so much change in the climate, so much carbon dioxide being pulled out of the atmosphere.
Oh yeah, because it's releasing oxygen.
Yep. And then so much of like when these fall down and die and there's rot. It is called the Great Devonian Extinction, and it's about 359 to 300 million years ago, and they believe, the scientists, believe that it wiped out nearly 80% of marine life. Maybe half of marine life.
Oh, no kidding.
Yep. So anyway, extinction, half of the planet's marine life.
Oh, gosh.
So all of a sudden, you get all these trees are killing the fishes, and it's a big battle. So I lied. There are tree wars.
See?
The tree wars. The late Devonian period.
But that's interesting because it was out of balance. And so it was killing off other things.
Killing off everything. And then that led into the Carboniferous age, the coal age. So all these plant material dies, right? So what coal and oil and all that stuff is, it's just biomass.
Okay.
And then it gets pressed really hard when it gets covered.
Mm-hmm.
And that created coal. So when we burn coal, we are releasing a bunch of ancient carbon dioxide into the air. That's a big reason why coal burning is so climate warming.
Oh.
Because we release all that carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide traps heat into the earth. Boom. See, you connect the dots. And next thing you know, you say, oh, that's what the puzzle is. It's a farmhouse with a with a bridge. So this is where we start seeing tall ferns and like the horsetails, all the weeds.
Oh,
all the stuff we consider weeds now. Those were the star of the show back in the day.
Oh.
Yep.
So they're surviving.
Yep. All right. So then we got trees. Let's go into plants such as conifers and ginkgos.
Okay.
Okay. So conifer trees, you know, pine trees, all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
They start popping up. And then ginkgos pop up. Ginkgos were some of those most pervasive plants and trees in the world.
Mm.
Guess how many are left?
Five.
One. Ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo biloba, and we use it for health reasons, to make our skin better, whatever ginkgo biloba does.
Oh, no kidding.
I don't even know that. But anyway, during this time, seeds. This is where we start getting the seeds. So they could start reproducing without moisture, because we went into a drying period. So
my goodness,
the world
really?
Goes into in and out of drying periods.
Right.
Yep. So we're going to skip through. Then we get to the Permian period. That's about 300 million years ago on. They started developing leaves, like tongue-shaped leaves, so they could capture more sunlight and water on the leaves.
Oh, like how the leaves are flat?
Yep.
Nice.
But during the end of this period, so this is where they got real trees. Mm-hmm. Real trees everywhere, ginkgo trees and coniferous trees. And it's amazing. But this was the most catastrophic extinction event in Earth.
Oh.
So this is several million years, carbon dioxide levels on the Earth rose, probably caused by massive volcano activity at the time. Mm-hmm. And the result was extreme global warming that led to the collapse of most global ecosystems, including the oceans. So this is only 100 million years after the marine life extinction because of all the debris.
Yeah.
Well, now we got a bunch of global warming because of volcanoes and extra carbon dioxide because of all these trees. And this one, it's estimated that over 80% of the marine species disappeared and 70% of the vertebrate species on land went extinct.
Whoa, that's a significant
amount. So if you don't think global warming is a big deal, it's a big deal. 80%, 70%.
Mm-hmm.
With that being said, I don't know what we're at right now because we're in an interglacial period. Mm-hmm. But anyway, but amazingly, mm-hmm. some life survived and we got into the Mesozoic area, which is the dinosaur age.
Oh.
This is the dinosaur age.
Oh, so this was all before we had these big...
This is even before the dinosaurs.
These
plants and these early things are rough. They're going through some rough times.
Well, there's multiple extinction events before we hit dinosaur and modern day.
Yep, yep. So there's 600 species of conifer trees, which is dominates the Earth,
okay,
right, today. But there's only one ginkgo.
Ginkgo bola.
Okay, last little bit. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not enthralled already with all this plant talk and just so engaged with what I'm saying, now we get into the show. The flowery show.
Oh, I like flowers.
The origins of the angiosperms or flowering plants. They outnumber all the other groups combined. Because everybody loves flowers. And everybody's going to the Costcos and they're saying, how are roses this cheap? Mm-hmm. And boom, next thing you know, people are growing more roses.
Mm-hmm.
But about 90% of all land plants are angiosperms or flowering plants.
Oh.
And even Charles Darwin, and nobody knows why. Why do you decide to have flowers? Who knows? Maybe you're aliens. Because even Charles Darwin said that flowering plants are an abominable mystery. He says it. It's in quotes.
Oh, is it?
Abominable mystery. Anyway, they appear subtly in the fossil records and quickly diversify to become the dominant flora on Earth.
So they're just because they're pretty.
They just showed up one day, probably from an asteroid or something like that. But colorful flowers, again, to attract more animals to them.
Right.
So then the pollen from the plant, they eat the pollen, but then the seeds and the ova from the plants and all that good stuff gets trapped to the bees and gets trapped to the birds and then they fly off and then the plants can spread.
Oh,
plants need to spread, just like all of us.
Just like
so they have a presence of an ovary, which acts like a container to protect the seed inside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the womb. So all these little plants, these mommy plants, have all these ovas in them. And then the gymnosperms are called naked seedless plants because their seeds are exposed.
Oh,
those
goodness.
Are the mommies that are just out there saying, whatever, my babies are tough, they can handle it. Because you know the mom that says, all right, I'm going to wrap you in bubble wrap.
Mm-hmm.
When you go get on the skateboard. In fact, skateboards are too dangerous. Knitting class. You're going to play the flute, you know? But then you got some moms that are saying, I think my kid's playing on the freeway today. Those crazy kids. That's what the two plants are.
Gotcha.
Right?
Gotcha.
So you got those two. Uncontested. Okay. So they believe that these started showing up about 125 million years ago. And there are two plants in the fossil records having ovaries.
Okay.
Flowers are one of these. They lack petals. And then there's pollen producing stamens.
Oh, uh-huh.
Right? By about 100 million years ago, so angiosperms already spanned the globe from the tropics to the poles. Everywhere. Uh-huh. By 85 million years ago, they were the dominant group on Earth, displacing conifers, all these other trees. And while it would impact the Earth's flora, especially species that lacked dormancy adaption, so when it gets cold, they go dormant, and then it gets nice, they go out again. By the end, only 10% of the plant species went extinct.
Oh, no kidding.
So like during the great dinosaur asteroid.
So
after the dinosaurs died and killed all of them over a certain
amount of time.
All
the flowers were there.
All the flowers were like, yeah, I'm fine. I just went to sleep for a bit. No big deal.
Oh, that's really... They really are the crocodiles of the world.
They're the crocodiles.
The flowers
are the crocodiles. Yep. So anyway, we went into a cooling period after the dinosaurs and then a glacial period where like glaciers came down all the way down from covered, North America, Europe, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And these plants said, yeah, no big deal. And bigs. Then we came out of that ice age about 12,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and we're in an interglacial period.
Oh.
Which is like the prime period. I'm going to say it's the prime period.
Ooh, where you have like Hawaii.
You have Hawaii.
Like a,
you
the,
have sandals.
The perfect.
Sandals resort. It's perfect. You show up to sandals and you say, I'm so glad we're in an interglacial period.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we were in a glacial period, sandals would be freezing. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't
be
need
so
socks.
Cold.
I'd need my socks with my sandals, and that is a fashion faux pas. Or I'd be in a volcanic, climate-warmed, carbon dioxide heavy.
Too much.
And it's just too hot.
Mm-hmm.
You can't drink enough beer.
Is it?
Or sodas. I don't know what you drink.
Lemonade.
There you go. Ah! 20 minutes.
That's amazing.
Okay, you're welcome. Who knew I could talk for so long about plants? If you want me to just talk about plants, email or give me a phone call. I'll talk about plants all day. I am an amateur paleobotanist.
Amateur
now,
semi-pro.
Now, after researching this yesterday.
Amateur semi-pro.
Okay. All right, so that's it. That's all I got for my history of plants. Woo!
That's a good one.
That was fast.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot. I crammed in 500 million years in 20 minutes. In 18 minutes.
You're welcome.
You're welcome, everybody. All right, but we're going to get into why that's so important.
Yes.
They worked hard for us.
Mm-hmm.
They survived for millions and hundreds of millions of years, so you can put it on your desk at work,
mm-hmm.
and that plant can make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's get into the science.
So this came up because of my concerns about our sun going to Mars.
You want to know what happens to your brain when you leave our terrestrial planet.
Yep. And let me tell you,
it's
not great.
It's not great.
So there's some pretty rough things that happen. So just with astronauts as is, but also like long-term astronauts have a lot of battles that they have to deal with. So obviously they're feeling isolated. There's depression, anxiety, sleep disturbances because your sleep cycles are way off because you don't have like a normal system that you would have on Earth. But you also get personality changes, cognitive decline, cognitive distress, and then skin scratching and chewing and hair pulling.
So you become a dumb jerk with
all
a bunch
of
sores.
You become a zombie. Yeah, so.
Is that why all astronauts are zombies?
What, is that true?
I don't think so. They're amazing.
They are amazing.
The cream of America's crop. All countries' crop, not just America.
That's true. Just
cream
all
of the crop.
Of the world. Right? But
we're bringing
some,
them back down to our levels, what we're doing.
Yeah. No. Okay. But some really, really interesting things, like the human brain and the way that we like psychologically deal with being in space, really rough. And that doesn't even go into like muscle and bone deterioration and all of like the actual physical things that
from
occur.
Lack of gravity.
Yeah. Yeah, but the actual like mental health of our astronauts is pretty rough. So that got me down a separate rabbit hole. And then we went into the biophilia. So biophilia is the positive impact of on well-being that's affected by nature.
Right.
And it affects our three systems. So physiologically, so it calms our heart rate and increases serotonin, which then reduces anxiety and depression.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense.
It's fantastic. Psychologically, it reduces anger and fear and just general distress, like our general distress signals. And then cognitive functioning, it improves creativity, memory, and just general mood.
So when you're in the forest, you're peaceful and you're smart.
As long as you have your general needs met. If you're lost in the forest, I'm pretty sure you don't have these.
I don't think, do people get lost in the forest?
Tons of people get lost in
no,
the forest.
No, I don't think that's ever happened before. Our native instincts, our natural instincts kick in.
And then you just all of a sudden can find berries?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I eat all the berries when I'm out in nature.
It's such a bad idea.
Never been gone. Okay.
But nature in general has a lot of good things.
Yes.
We'll just put it there. So biophiliac design is an approach to architecture in which we take nature concepts and we bring them in.
Oh, so you're talking how to bring nature to the urban environment.
Yes.
All right.
So, and lately, this is not the case. So if you think of our homes now, the minimalist and the whites and grays of our, exactly what our house is,
mm-hmm.
that is not biophiliac design.
It's like living on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Might as well live on the moon.
Exactly.
Okay.
So what happens is, when we incorporate these things, and I'm going to tell you the specific things to add into your environment in order to get the benefits, the most benefits, because we're not living in a forest. I'm not going to bring a tree into my house necessarily. Ooh, I do have a tree in my house, but like
no
an
trees.
Actual living, like I'm not going to go live in a tree.
which would be cool, but
it would be cool, but I'm not going to do that. So how do I bring this in? But what happens when we use these designs that come in? So our amygdala, which you know is the fight, flight, freeze.
Okay.
It's our reactionary piece that, makes us fight the monster or whatever that thing is. It actually lowers the amygdala activation and it makes it less reactive to things.
We're less reactionary to stimuli in our environment, which makes us calmer.
It makes us calmer. Okay. It makes us less big in our reactions.
Makes sense.
We can actually assess things better instead of just having the amygdala take over and have us run out the door or fight something.
All right.
And they found that it's about 60 minutes in nature in a week span. And I'll go into how to actually break that down.
So you only need 60 minutes in a week? 6D. You need an hour in nature a week.
Yeah, but how this works is they took these folks and they were in a sterile environment and then they took them outside. So you actually have more benefits the more that you're in nature or the more that you can add these elements into your home, because then you don't have the contrast, I guess, between the amygdala reaction and then the lack of reaction.
Okay.
Does all of that make sense?
Yeah,
how this study was set up?
I think so. It was a very extreme study.
It was a very extreme study, yes. So what we're looking for is that we're trying to calm the amygdala so that the prefrontal cortex and the hypothalamus can react in appropriate ways. So just to recap, the prefrontal cortex is all of your cognitive function, your memory, your emotions, your impulse control, problem solving, social interaction, and motor function.
It's our upper brain.
It is very important.
Okay.
Very, very important. And then our hypothalamus is all the hormones, and then in turn it affects our mood.
Okay.
So if you're looking, we want all of these to function well, and if our amygdala is always taking over, they can't.
Because it's our primitive brain.
It's our primitive brain just taking over and running around.
Grab a rock and kill something.
It becomes overreactive in this. Okay, so the elements that are really big in how we can add this into the biophiliac design, natural light. So we can't all have a bunch of windows. I know we've lived in basements and things, and it's rough. It's a rough time frame. So the thing with natural light, our brain reacts to, the way that we calculate light in our brains, it actually needs to change throughout the day. So it has to do with how warm the light is, how much light, and then actually the actual change. So the spectrum of color, if you're going to add some natural light into your world, you can do this with light bulbs and things, but it's more about the spectrum of light and then the quality of light based on the day. So we have the little alarm clock that progressively lights up, I guess.
Sunrise alarm clock, yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually very good for our brains, because even though we're not awake, our brain goes, oh, the sun's coming up. And so it's a progressive wake up instead of the screaming wah, wah, wah of an alarm clock that creates a cortisol bump right as we wake up.
And it's amazing. If that light hits your face on that alarm clock, you wake up. And you wake up more naturally.
Yeah, and waking up with the sunrise and all of that, that's actually how our sleep cycles and our wake cycles are supposed to be happening. And so we actually go against all of it in our modern day.
Right, makes sense.
And then we're sitting in sterile environments, either in our homes or all day long at our works. And then so our body's all kinds of off. So if you notice, we're having personality changes, we're having anxiety, depression, all of that, all of our environment is impacting us. So the light is a big deal, and it's actually the movement of light as well. I know that most of you have probably gone running or walked through a park when the light goes through trees. So there's this interesting brain function when light goes through trees, or it changes as you're walking through. So you have shadow and light periods as you're walking through, and it goes on, off, on, off, on, off, right? That is actually very good for our brains, because it's engaging different parts of our executive functioning, because our brain's going, oh, on, off, on, off, on, off. But it's that you're moving through nature.
Interesting, because when we just have our screens in front of us, it's constant light.
Yep,
just
it's screaming right at you.
Okay.
Whereas this is a difference of light. Okay, so light, very important. Next, visual complexity, but not being cluttered. So if you look at a tree, for example, a tree has a system put into place, right? It's not necessarily cluttered, but it's very complex. And so we, as in our environments, are actually very non-complex, which is not what we're going for. We're going for complex, but not cluttered. And so when it's cluttered, it actually creates anxiety in us and our cortisol goes up. So if we have a lot of doodads in our house, it makes it really anxiety provoking. But when you go into like a cathedral, for example, that is organized complexity. So they actually talk about the way that you feel when you go into a cathedral is not the fact that, I mean, it can be that spirituality for you, but it is that it is a complex system that is organized similar to a tree.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the ventilation, you should have temperature changes. So you should actually feel uncomfortable. You should get a little too hot. You should get a little too cold. There should be changes, being able to have natural air come through. Plants, as long as they're not cluttered. The thing with plants is that sometimes people they're like, I'm going to put plants everywhere, like I live in a forest. That actually doesn't do anything for us, because the way that plants actually grow in an environment, it's based on their survival, and it's complex, but it's not cluttered, because if it's cluttered, they wouldn't survive.
Makes sense.
So that's part of that. Water. So the way they tested this was if you can have water in your world, so a fountain or even water sounds, but the water sounds have to be friendly water.
Oh, not angry water.
Not angry water.
Okay.
So a babbling brook, right? If you're having rain, it's a light rain. It's not...
A hurricane,
yeah. So it's very specific, because then it alerts us to concern, and it you have amygdala activation at that point.
Okay.
So it's friendly water. Same with the sounds. If you have a... Okay, so they had a seaside natural sounds where it has like the little seagulls and all this kind of stuff. And then they had a sea sounds, but it had like a tiger roaring in the background, or like a cougar. It's same thing. You want them to be friendly nature noises. And then you want as much wood, copper, and stone uses in your home, because it actually creates that natural environment and the like complexity of wood. Is really, like, if you look at wood, it's not just a flat surface that's white, right? It has, you know, the, what is that called?
Grain? Bark.
Grains. No, look at the wood.
The grain,
yeah. It has different, how the tree was grown and that kind of thing. It has a organized complexity to it.
Interesting. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. So those are the elements that really affect our brain. And those are the elements that are actually using for astronauts. They're trying to bring this in so that astronauts don't go crazy.
So are they designing the space stations and the rocket ships with nice wood paneling interiors?
Ooh.
Like a GMC luxury automobile or a Cadillac?
Kind of.
What? That's great.
Yeah. And it's because it really psychologically, it does a lot for us as humans.
Okay.
We need nature, guys.
So there you go. More wood paneling everywhere. Just throw the wood paneling up, people. You heard it here from Jesse.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you how to actually put it into... Because I like the way... I like a minimalist house. I think it looks nice.
Right.
But then how do you bring those elements in so that you're not in a completely sterile environment?
Yeah, where you've got a bunch of trees and toucans flying around your house.
Oh, can you get a toucan?
Yeah, they are like pests down in... Parrots and toucans are like pesty animals in Brazil.
Let's get a parrot. He just hangs out in our house and gets to... attack our cats.
I like it. Okay. All right. So that's the science between
the science.
Why we need nature in our homes and our workplaces.
Yes.
All right. I like it. Let's go do a quick coffee segment, and then we'll talk about how to implement this properly without just throwing plants everywhere.
Yep. Because we don't want it to be cluttered.
Okay.
I drank pots and pots and pots and pots of strong black coffee, trying to keep my sleepy soul awake. But the sleepiness still comes along, and when it does, it's fast and strong. I end up with a bad case of the shakes.
All right, I'm going to tell you about coffee in space.
Coffee in space.
Mm-hmm.
Space coffee.
Space coffee.
Is it dehydrated?
Well, so the Mercury program in the early 1960s.
This was the first space. This was the first people in space. We're talking Alan Shepard.
Mm-hmm.
And... Buzz Aldrin,
mm-hmm.
all those guys.
So John Glenn was mm-hmm. the first American.
John Glenn, the best, yeah.
Yeah, was the first American to drink coffee in space. However, the type of coffee that he drank was a powdered drink mix with water. It wasn't warm.
Mm.
It was just water, powder mix. So think about, you like the instant coffee,
mm-hmm.
but lukewarm.
Oh, I like it. Okay.
It's so bad. But it's still coffee.
Still, he got it. He got it done.
The okay. coffee. So did you know that there was a William Shepard?
We have a son named William Shepard. Mm-hmm. There is an astronaut named William Shepard. Did he drink coffee too?
He did. He had a specialty coffee design machine. So it was kind of like an espresso machine. Kind of. The International Space Station has it or had it in 2001. And it uses little capsules. And not like the K-pods. Not the K-pods, but like a little, like almost like a pill capsule. And it was a pressurized microgravity machine. So everything was very pressurized. And it took coffee grounds out of this capsule and then made it into a kind of warm cup of coffee.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it was a pretty cool. The thing is with coffee in space, if any coffee grounds get out,
you breathe it in.
It's bad news. Yeah. You literally could breathe it in.
Yeah.
And then you have coffee grounds in your lungs.
That's why they don't use pencils in space either.
Yeah. Because of the little shards that come off. Uh-huh. So actual coffee is a big problem. So they use these capsules. It works fairly well. William Shepard, I looked up his picture. He looks very heroic.
Okay.
So that was in 2001. 2008, Don Pettit created a zero gravity coffee cup. Because the big thing is that these coffees that they were drinking beforehand were in like these pouches. So it would be like a straw and right. you'd be sucking it out of
it. It's a Capri Sun, a coffee Capri Sun. You don't want to do that.
Capri Sun. That's exactly what it was.
Did he just invent a tumbler with a straw?
No. So this is actually pretty cool because he wanted to do like an actual coffee. Like you drink a coffee like we have our mugs right now.
All right.
He wanted to be able to drink it because the idea, drinking liquids in space is pretty rough. So he didn't do anything around the coffee grounds. It was just the coffee liquid. And coffee liquid, he wanted to do a cheers. He wanted to be able to cheers and then drink the coffee
liquid. During their space parties.
Yeah, as you do.
Yeah.
And so what this is, it is a... It looks kind of like a teardrop, like a airplane wing. And the way I don't know the physics of anti-gravity very well, but it's like a tear. So it's a teardrop shape with like a fluid flow kind of thing. So you could still put your lip on it and think of it as like it channels the fluid into your mouth, but then it has a lip to bring it back down. So you're drinking, you have to actively sip it is the only thing. You have to actively sip it. But then when you bring it away from your mouth, there's like a little lip to bring it back into like the little teardrop pod in the bottom.
I get what's happening. So it's going in like a circle. So it's circling in the cup and then you can sip it out of the circle.
Yes. Yeah. So you don't have to have a straw. You can sip it. But then when it leaves your face, it circles back into the cup.
Why don't we have that now? On Earth. I want this teardrop sippy cup. Yeah. I spill my coffee every day. This would prevent that.
Little sippy cup. Yeah.
Okay.
So this was pretty cool. And they still use it today. So it's still used today.
Nice.
Yeah. So 2013, there was a trio of students. They called themselves the Houston We Have Coffee. And the big piece with this was that up until 2013, they couldn't put sugar or cream in their coffee at all. It was just this. These are the pouches. This is how it was brewed. Because adding things to other things in space is very difficult to not have splash out.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they designed a system of bags and hoses that made it so there was a freeze-dried cream and sugar. And then you could inject how much you wanted. Goes back to the Capri Sun. So into those little sippy bags. It injects it with hot water and the coffee, and then you could put a certain amount in there so that you could have cream and sugar into your coffee in space. And it was free-dried Kona coffee is what they use, and what they use actually now. Kona coffee is their main use in space.
Okay.
And I think because it's stronger.
We talked about this on the airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to higher elevations, less pressurization, all that stuff, your senses get depleted.
Yes, because there's no particles to go into your nose.
Yep.
And so you're only tasting it in your mouth.
So they want really, really rich mm-hmm. foods.
Yeah.
Real salty, real spicy, mm-hmm. real coffee-y.
Yeah. And so that's why they use the Kona coffee.
Right.
So that was 2013. So made it so they could, you know, like specially personalized their coffee, which was pretty fun. And then in 2015, they created a new machine called the IsisPro.
To the International Space Station.
Yep, but it's an espresso machine.
Okay.
They brought it up. It was a whole big thing. And it made it so you can make hot beverages. So not only coffee, but tea and broth, which was a big deal to have a warm liquid.
You have your soup.
Yeah, you want to have these different things.
You have your soup in the afternoon. You look at your plant under the UV light. Boom. You never need to come down again.
You got all the things
you need.
So it's a machine that works by first pressurizing into a pod. So it is kind of like the K-Cup. But it's more durable. Mm-hmm. It's more durable because if you lose anything, I've exploded enough K-cups at our office. We use them and little particles of grounds go everywhere. Yeah. So these are way more durable. But it starts there and it heats the water to 201 degrees Fahrenheit. And then it pumps it through steel tubing and pressurizes the coffee, which then is pumped into a pouch. So if you want to, you can still use the little zero gravity coffee cup. You just move it from the pouch into the coffee cup. It's usually like a very delicacy thing. They don't do it all the time because normally you would just drink everything out of your pouch. But it's pressurized, so everything is very self-contained, and it's a lot more palatable because the coffee is actually going through coffee grounds. It's not instant coffee anymore.
I like it. I want that job. That's the most important job at NASA. Forget the rockets. Forget the worms cell dividing.
Mm-hmm.
Get me warm coffee with the amount of cream and sugar I want in it. Or you know what? I'm turning the space station around and I'm going somewhere else.
I'm going to Mars, friends. Well, no, here's the thing. The food part of this, the reason why coffee was such a big deal and why so much time has been put into this is that this is good for their psychology. So as they're up there, and because it's a very isolating thing, depression, anxiety, isolation, the biting of your skin, and not just your nails, like the actual biting of your skin, pulling out hair is way more common in astronauts. We don't talk about it because, you know, they're heroes. We have a certain persona of what they are, but it is psychologically distressing being in space if you don't have these things. So if you can have your morning cup of coffee, which assists in the sleep cycle sequence as well,
okay,
they're a lot more successful being able to stay up there longer, do their science studies and things like that if they have these elements. So a lot of time went into these, and for good reason, I think.
I love it.
Mm-hmm.
There's your space coffee.
Yeah, see, space
so
coffee.
If you find yourself on the International Space Station,
as you do,
most of us will at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have to give up coffee.
Nope, I have a pouch of coffee ready for me.
I'm going to get my Capri coffees.
Capri coffees.
All right, I like it. This is great. This is good to know.
Interesting,
I wanted to go to the space station, but I'm not going to not have coffee.
Absolutely.
So I just told them no.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I'm sorry. I know you really want me to be an astronaut. You're looking for a middle-aged man who's not very active? Yeah, I'm the guy. But no, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. So when you go to space or your family member goes to space, you say, it's okay. They got you covered.
Got your coffee.
All right. I love it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's go back into how to incorporate this into those of us who are not in space.
Because not all of us are going to space, but we can still utilize the principles.
But okay. All right, let's do some action planning.
Let's hope you make the most of it, my boy.
So I want you to go through your home or your workplace or just pick a specific space. And I want you to assess these different things. And then we're going to try to implement these elements into that space in order for it to get the feel different. So a lot of this is assessing how you feel, but it is important because if you're always distressed at work in your office, let's say, it could simply be because it feels so sterile that your amygdala is being enacted.
Okay. So if you live or work in a modernist building without any plants, you don't have big windows overlooking parks, you could be having a fight, flight, freeze reaction.
Yeah, and that might be why you have such a distressing response to that area. Whether, let's say you really dread going to work, it could simply be the environment that you're in.
So every time you want to murder your boss, it's probably you don't have enough plants in your office.
Get some plants. No, here we go. So these are the things that I want you to assess. So pick your space. I want you to assess the natural light, and that has to do with the warmth, the changing, and the on-off of it. a lot of times you're not going to get the quick on off.
Flip your light switch on and off real quick.
No, but like the warmth of it. So you can bring down your lights a little bit, make it a little warmer, especially if you want it to be a calmer space. The visual complexity of it. So not cluttered. If it's cluttered, it will create distress, but the visual complexity. So if you have like, I guess wood paneling, not necessarily wood paneling.
Maybe some nice furniture. Wood furniture.
Wood furniture with maybe a pattern on it or a pillow. You can even just add a pillow. This doesn't have to be big pieces, but that has a pattern on it of some kind. So something to give it a little complexity while still making it, you know, calm and minimal to a point. Ventilation. Can you open a window? If you can't open a window, like in my office, I can't open any windows.
Me neither.
Yeah. So, but if you can get a fan, you can get something to create some movement. And a lot of times they try to keep temperatures at a specific, so you're going to be kind of the same, but maybe you can walk outside and be cold or be hot or whatever the things are, and then re-enter your office building.
Okay, I like that.
Same with your home. Most homes have open windows due to fire regulations. So trying to open those up and let the temperature in your home change.
Okay,
which
like
sounds
that.
Silly, but honestly,
but
think
it.
About it.
But we
yeah.
don't do it.
Yeah, so make sure you have good ventilation. Getting a plant. So I was not joking about the Moss Amigos. They're the...
Get a club fern or a club moss. Get a club moss.
Club moss. What are you talking about?
Oh, the Moss Amigos. You're talking about the ball of moss, in a jar.
Yes.
That's just moss algae.
Yeah.
And it lives in water. That's a water plant.
And you get it a hat.
And you get it a hat. If you haven't seen these.
It's a cowboy hat. Oh, it has a little beanie. They're kind of pricey, but oh, they're so amazing.
But you can get
it
a
makes
Moss
a difference.
Amigo.
Yeah.
But it does make a difference. Okay.
So it's in a minimalist environment, so it doesn't feel like it clutters your area, but you have, and the Moss Amigos does not sponsor us. I just love them. but it has a little hat. You can like make it all cute, but it really does have this idea of like you're bonding with this little plant, and it helps. So
I thought you were just saying like when Moss Amigos, I thought you just meant the phrase. You're talking about the product.
The actual,
so those
a
of you
little
who don't
moss.
Know, there's a ball of stone and then it's covered in moss and it's in a jar.
Yeah.
And you buy it hats and fun accessories.
Yeah, you can
and
put little...
And it sits on your desk and it's a living moss ball.
Yes.
And but it's called Moss Amigo.
It's called a Moss Amigo. You can, there's different ones. You can like look around. That's just the one I know of because of the little hats. But it's having that thing in your area.
So a plant or a Moss Amigo ball or whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever it is. It's just something that's alive that's near you. So a plant. Don't get a ton of them. Don't make yourself a forest. That doesn't do us any good. It's really more about this idea of adding. This is why offices like have plants random places. You're like, why would you put a plant here? It's because it makes it more welcoming. It makes it more comfortable and you're less likely to have that amygdala hit.
Okay. That makes
sense. Yeah. Friendly water noises and nature noises.
Okay. Can this just be on the Google machine? Or...
It can.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to put a fountain in my room.
Right.
Like it's just, I mean, you can't, I guess you can get a small fountain and get the little water thing, but then they splash. Do you remember in our first house how we made that really cool fountain, but it splattered everywhere.
And it warped all the floor and the whole works, but it was a cool fountain.
It was super cool. It had like the copper piping and all this kind of stuff. So that was a good idea, but it warped our house, which created more distress.
Right.
So that wasn't going to work. So you can do a little fountain. They have like the little water fountains, which is great. Or you can just put it on the Google machines, which a lot of people have. Like we have one in each bedroom and you can listen to music and stuff. Put on some little thunder noises or like something really mellow.
Babbling brook, a creek.
Little birds chirping, something like that. Some sort of friendly. It actually calms your the reactivity of your nervous system.
All right.
So you want to get a parasympathetic response, put on some friendly nature noises. And then last, try to incorporate some sort of natural feature in your home. So wood, stone, copper is a big one, actually.
Some kind of centerpeece.
Yeah.
Some kind of art you're
you
talking?
You can do art. You can have it be your furniture.
Well, like your table, your dining table.
Mm-hmm.
Make it wood. Make it wood. Mm-hmm. Like legit. You go have a lumberjack cut down a gigantic tree and make you a giant table.
Reclaim some barn wood. Put it in your dining room. Some sort of feature like that. If you have something like that in each of the rooms, it really does help.
Okay.
So whether it is a stone or a copper or something, it's interesting with copper because like I never walk around in nature and go, oh, hey, there's a copper something.
But like it helps.
But it helps, and it's the natural look of it. Like, it has a natural look to it, but it also starts to change and...
It patinas.
That's the word I was looking for. So it changes, and that's why people put these features on places, and it's such a, like, a, ooh, that feels so nice and warm in my soul. It has this, it has an actual reaction in your brain. And so as you want to have one of those in each room. So take a room, do that, check all those things, try to incorporate it. And then if we need to actually get into nature too, if you can, most people can at least go out in some area that has some sort of green, right?
A park.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be even the woods, that most, wherever. That complex, the woods. You're just like, I'm just walking in the woods, whatever. Yeah. But like with Eagle Mountain, getting out into nature of any kind, desert or whatever it is. But now you can go out in a 60-minute stint, like that original study, kind of how they isolated and then let them out for like an hour. It does have the same effect, but it's actually better if you do it in little stints all throughout the week. But what we would like to do is 20 minutes outside 3 days a week. And I was thinking about this, like, you have a regular office job at this point, and getting into nature during daylight hours would actually be very difficult.
It's harder for me to do that, correct?
Yes. So the 20 minutes outside 3 days a week, like on the weekends, you're outside all the time, like we mountain biking and all this kind of stuff. But to do this throughout the week is actually quite difficult. So it is more difficult for folks than I would think.
Especially during the winter when there's not a lot of sunlight.
Yeah, because you need that, part of that is the sunlight, right? You want to get out there in the sunlight. But so trying to get out at least 20 minutes 3 days a week is where you're going to get the optimal amount of benefit from being outside, but then also trying to bring this stuff into our day-to-day living spaces and our working spaces.
I love it. Okay, recap us.
Okay.
Number one,
pick an area. Number two, assess the light, the visual complexity, the ventilation, plant, happy noises, and natural materials.
Okay.
That's what you're assessing. You're trying to bring those in the best you can, whatever version of that is, but then still get outside.
So that's how you set up your spaces for success, but then also 20 minutes outside
20 minutes,
as much
3 days a week.
All right. That's it.
And easy,
then you don't have fight, flight, freeze. You don't want to yell at your coworkers. Your family's all peaceful and
everybody's
singing by the campfire.
Well, I think the big thing is that we understand that we really do have psychological distress around not having these elements. So if you have an office job, or if let's say you game a lot, that kind of thing, you still need to get out of this minimal environment, because it's good for your brain, because you do have distress, psychological distress about not being there.
So if you're distressed at work or your home, look around. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're missing something. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're on the space station. That's where we're at. Okay, yeah. I like it. Well, there you go. So that's biophiliac design.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially a fancy word for loving trees.
Nature in your living environment.
Nature in your living environment. Mm-hmm. All right, I like it.
It's good for you.
Okay, well, that's all we had today. Thanks, everybody, for joining the Morning Struggle. So why don't we all go out there and...
build a better you.
Thanks, guys.